ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Okay. I do understand. Thank you all for your time. We will make a short statement shortly. Oh, mayhem out there in the media scrum, Lisa. You've got to make a statement as our new CEO.
That looked really intense for you just then. Yep, I will make a statement in just a tick.
You've really got to.
Okay, I'll do it in a minute. But I actually need to go to the bathroom.
Right now?
One moment.
Lisa. Lisa. No, Lisa, you've got to come back. No, Lisa!
So how do you react in a crisis? Are you fight, flight, fawn, or flee, as you heard at the top of the show? Hello, I'm Lisa Leong. Welcome to This Working Life on ABC Radio National, helping to make your work life better. Dr. James Donald is a senior lecturer in work and organisational studies at Sydney University, and he's been pondering panic in the office. G'day, James.
G'day, Lisa. Great to be here.
So you have a term for that moment of panic or crisis. What is it, James?
I call them Kairos moments, and it's a bit of a techie sort of term which we can unpack, but it's an ancient Greek idea that I think is pretty relevant to our modern world.
So what does Kairos mean in its original form then?
The Greeks had two words for time, at least two words actually, and one was Chronos, which is just regular time that we all kind of know and kind of live our lives by. But then they had this other idea, Kairos, which is that there are moments in time that are significant. And it's almost like Animal Farm, like all moments are equal, but some are more equal than others kind of thing. And so it's like there are moments that hold potential that are almost like windows in time that open. And if we can see those and then seize them, then there is the possibility for change.
Why do you find using the term Kairos helpful then when it comes to trying to handle something like panic or crisis moments?
I think it's actually a leadership question that you're getting to because, you know, we know the biology of crisis is pretty universal. So people feel stress. We know that, you know, you just at the top of the show kind of channeled the basic description of the stress response. So that biology is very, very universal. And yet in leadership roles, leadership asks something different of us. And so for me, this idea of developing the ability to see these moments as opportunities, that is Kairos. It's this sense in which in my capacity as a leader, there is something that this moment asks of me.
When we talk about our natural response, I'd love you to go deeper on what you're seeing as our natural response to crisis moments if we don't pay attention.
The stress response, the fight, flight, flee, fawn, et cetera, all the Fs, that is very universal. And I mean, there are two basic things happening there. You know, the first is that the limbic system, the ancient part of our brain, kicks in. The amygdala, it's like the body's house alarm, fires off and cascades all these stress hormones through the body and so on. And it's that well-known kind of basic response to stress. And then, of course, the newer, so-called newer networks in the brain, particularly in the prefrontal cortex, those go offline, to put it simply. And so that's responsible for all the complex judgment, decision-making, seeing nuance in situations, discerning moments, and all of that. If you think about all those words I've just described, well, what does that sound like? Well, that sounds like the work of leadership. And so the biology of what's happening in a crisis is very consequential for leaders in particular.
Why does it feel like crisis is the new norm at the moment? Like in the last fortnight, I think I had two leaders who described that they were having to attend crisis meetings, in quotation marks. So Talk about that.
I mean, I'd say two things there. I mean, one is it does feel like there is so much all happening at once. Geopolitics, AI, economic disruption, change, tech disruption. And so, like, this sense in which there's a lot going on all at the same time is very much a big part of that. And all of those kind of forces, even though a lot of them are more kind of distal, they're not like immediately affecting your everyday, they kind of play on us through the media and through the conversations that we have. I think the other part of this as well that's interesting to consider is that the idea of crisis is actually a relative term. And this is probably a slightly divergent kind of perspective on this, but there's a bit of a view that maybe we've become more sensitized to crisis to some extent as well. And so, like, calling that, like, evoking that idea, if you're living in Kyiv, you probably wouldn't, you know, describe our daily experience as being in a crisis. So, I mean, I think the point I'm trying to make there is that just it's very much a relative term, and that, yeah, people kind of respond and see what's happening around them and interpret that very differently. And from a leadership point of view, that matters a lot because that affects the people that are looking to you for direction.
Let's get some examples then. Can you give me an example of a leader who is leading in crisis and it's gone wrong in a public sense?
Probably one of the most, in the moment, examples I can think of would be like Qantas, and Alan Joyce has recently kind of acknowledged a lot of that with some of the decision making during COVID. And whatever you think of those decisions, there's an attempt or an effort to actually try and acknowledge and explain and kind of almost acknowledge what didn't go well. And so when I think about leading in crisis, I think of two key principles almost, Lisa. I can think of them like levers that you pull. And one of them is structure. What structure enables us to do is follow a process that if things are not working well, we can actually backtrack a little bit inside a structure. And you see that quite a bit. So, for example, late last year, Commonwealth Bank announced 45 employees were going to be made redundant due to AI automation, if you remember. And that was very quickly a big crisis for that organization, a PR crisis. But if, and there's a reason that people have almost forgotten about it, right? Because they handled it pretty well. And a big part of that was actually owning the moment and then, like, the CEO, Matt Corman, choosing to revert very consciously and explicitly choosing to reverse the decision and kind of wearing the cost of that. And you see that quite a lot at, you know, with CEOs and senior leaders who are in the center of these, like, PR storms. The ones that do it well acknowledge where they have made mistakes and are really explicit about that. And then from there, and only they're able to walk back to, okay, well, what does plan B look like?
It's This Working Life on ABC Radio National with Lisa Leong, and you're listening to Dr. James Donald about how we react to moments of panic and crisis at work. Coming up, we are going to talk about how do you actually handle this? What are the things that you can do to build good habits around crisis? So, James, you've wanted to canter into the things that we can do better. So you have talked about this response that we have, which is a natural response. So before we begin, what do we do in the moment when we absolutely have these natural responses, which we can't change?
This is where I talk about the idea of state. So in terms of managing a crisis, I think of it in terms of these two simple ideas, structure and state. And you can have the best structure in the world and it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is because by definition, a crisis is new. It wouldn't be a crisis if it was kind of something that was familiar. And that's where state matters a lot. What I mean by state is I simply mean your state of mind, the state that you're bringing to this moment of uncertainty and stress. That is everything. And so I think about that state. There are a number, I think about four key, if you like, drivers of what gets us into a state where we can respond choicefully.
Okay, what are these four drivers?
Firstly, attention. And I mean, it might sound obvious, but I mean, how many times have you been in a team where there's been something brewing around you and maybe your boss, for probably very good reasons, just hasn't seen it, hasn't read the moment? So attention, everything starts with attention, our capacity to be present in the moment that we're in. The second that I think about is your attitude. And I think about that as like your emotional ground, the emotional ground that you're arriving in that moment with. And when you think about the stress response and the biology of that that we've talked about, that process is kind of pushing your emotional ground toward defensiveness, ultimately. It's survival. And in a leadership context, in a crisis, that emotion, as understandable as it is just not helpful a lot of the time. And so we want to be cultivating attitudes of openness, of willingness, of these types of things. The third principle that I talk about, or habit that I talk about, that means we can show up in a state that's helpful is your assumptions, the assumptions or beliefs. And this is more the cognitive side of the ledger, if you like, Lisa. And that is, and you think about, again, moments that you've been in, often crises that are interpersonal in nature. This tends to play out quite a lot, where we have, it might be a key stakeholder or a colleague, you've got a bunch of ideas about what they think and what their motives are, for example. It's like a filter. It gets in the way of you being able to read the moment cleanly. And then the fourth habit that I talk about is almost the least visible, but it can quickly become the most visible if you haven't managed it well. And that would be your intent. Or another way of thinking about it, it could be your values, or it's like, what am I in service of in this moment? The reason I'll just say that I think that matters so much, it's less visible because it's not public knowledge, but it can quickly become that. And I just think of, for example, like the KPMG crisis going on right now in Australia. You know, if you lose touch with what you're in service of, under stress, you default to expediency. It's biology playing out. You just want to get to the cave as quickly as you can, and you don't care how who you trample over to get there. But of course, that expediency, when you play that out, that can turn into some questionable decision making, and then unethical, illegal, and then you end up in a full blown crisis like a KPMG at the moment. So I think of those four as the key kind of almost like foundations of your state.
Obviously, this gets tested in that moment of crisis. So you mentioned the words habits and cultivate. So I'm hearing it's like something that you've been practicing. So how do you actually develop these before the crisis hits?
Yeah, it's such a good point, Lisa. And it's a little, the analogy I like is it's a bit like going to the gym and then being, you know, expecting, you know, I'm in Sydney to run the city to surf. They just had a couple of weeks ago, but it's not going to happen if you haven't done the training or a marathon. And it's exactly the same. So whilst your state is, it's like a paradox, you know, structure cannot give you presence. So you need to actually be in the moment that you're in, but yet without the practice and the training, it's that much harder.
Okay, so we've got this cultivation of a state which is helpful in Kairos moments. You mentioned just briefly the idea of structure. Can we go to the next level on that then, James?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the way that I think about it is that as a manager, when you're in a stressful, in a crisis moment of dislocation, everyone is experiencing the stress response and they're looking to you, right? And then that's why it can be so much harder as a manager, because it's not just your stress you're dealing with, it's everyone else's. And by the way, stress is contagious, as we know from the research. And so, you know, that can be a pretty powerful cocktail for rapid escalation of very negative emotions. And anyone that's been in an organizational change process will know exactly what I'm talking about, right? And so this stuff is very contagious. And so if you're the manager or you're a more senior leader, like if, for example, you're leading a change process, the thing that you want to do psychologically there is do something to help people's attention focus, and structure gives you that. So structure, if you like, is a powerful way of capturing people's attention in a more constructive way.
What do you mean by structure?
Good question. So what I mean is the process or the method that your expertise and your experience in your kind of domain of your field works 75% of the time. So for example, if you are in, I'll just pick, you know, in a team going through a change process, like there are some basic principles for leading change that generally work. And things, if you do those things in order well, like you'll get there. And these principles are pretty simple. I'm happy to unpack some of those in a minute, but it also applies, you know, for example, if you're a surgeon, you know, leading a complex surgical operation, there is a procedure to follow. If you're a paramedic, you know, turning up onto a scene that you know that is quite challenging and confronting, there's still a kind of a protocol for you to turn to that just helps by not just you, but the situation, the people around you, a level of it just de-escalates that nervous system response and gives people a sense of constructive focus for making progress.
Should we have a crisis process or structure?
Yeah, well, that's right. And I mean, I think of it in very, very simple terms, Lisa. So I think there are like four simple steps that tend to play out in most crises. And they would be, you know, firstly, have you actually acknowledged that you're in a crisis? Like you're in a moment that's not just BAU, business as usual. The second thing is typically in a crisis moment, it could be in a healthcare setting, in a workplace setting, it could be any kind of context. We tend to want to jump in, even as the manager, because we take responsibility. And yet step number two is often the opposite. And so it's, yeah, number one, I've seen the issue, but number two is I'm actually going to pull back here. And rather than just jumping in, I'm going to assess the situation. I'm going to figure out, do I have all the information that I need? Have I actually tested the assumptions that I have about this moment? Have I actually heard from the voices that I need? You know, for example, if it's in a workplace context, in a team context, we're trying to solve some new problem or a change of direction or a loss of a customer, have I heard those voices? So that's getting all of that. Three would be coming to a decision. And it's actually interesting in a crisis, and you see this a bit, Lisa, leadership teams often struggle with this because people don't want to actually own the solution. They don't want to take, it's very natural, right? People are freaked out. And yet, and then if you're not landing on a decision about, here's what we're going to do at least for the next week, it's very hard to communicate that. It's impossible, actually. So you want to make sure you're getting to a decision and then a plan. And then four, typically, is moving pretty quickly into implementation. Because the thing about a crisis is, by definition, you're not in familiar territory. And so you don't have a lot to go on, but you do have implementation. You do have short, quick, you know, you can talk about experiments that can buy you or gain you feedback that mean you're getting in more information than you would have otherwise quite quickly. And then you can iterate again from there. So for me, those four steps are quite simple and they tend to apply pretty universally.
Simple but difficult to actually execute, it seems.
Totally.
James, where do
totally.
We fall down the most, in your opinion?
Do you mean in that process, that structure I've described?
Yeah. Well, so I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, I wonder whether even the acknowledging, like many people, it feels like silence feels safer, but I don't know whether it is.
When you're in a leadership role, silence can be pretty deadly. There are many examples of this that play out from time to time in the media. It's like, you know, where were they? We were waiting for a response and they took 3 days to communicate. Some of the telco outages recently, for example, are good examples of that that got media attention around this in Australia, around, well, like, you were too slow to actually call it and to respond. So that can cost you. But at every step, unfortunately, Lisa, there are big challenges and there are opportunities to fall over. Probably the big one about step number one, about calling it, and this plays out a lot. I mean, I'll just pick Qantas as an example from last year. They had also had a significant data breach last year. But their CEO was very quick. think she might have been on holidays, came back at Vanessa Hudson and quickly acknowledged it was a major failing, even though it was like a third-party contractor. So that, step number one, you can't underestimate the power. And this applies in a small team of five people as much as it does to a massive corporation, by the way, of acknowledging and calling it step number one. It's very, very powerful because then people know that you know. And it kind of disarms a lot of that negative feeling and resentment that can build up very quickly.
James, I feel like we can all be practicing these habits then of state. So attention, attitude, assumptions and intent or our values. So we have this segment called Try This, where every week we ask our expert guests to pick an experiment that we can run and then we all try it for the week and then we feedback. So
fantastic.
What can we try this week, all of us, to help us handle Kairos moments or those moments of panic in the office, James?
No, absolutely. Well, I might share a simple tool that I personally use a lot when it comes to state, because structure is something that's learned and it's a function of my environment, of my profession, of my professional expertise, but state is universal. And so I use a simple tool to help me with my state and with the teams that I work with and coach and so on and my students at Sydney University called the STOP exercise. And it's very, very simple, but it's very useful. S-T-O-P. And it's not mine, by the way, but it's I like it a lot. So the idea is you start with S. And then this might be before, just to give a bit of context, before you're going into an important meeting or an important conversation. It's just, it takes about a minute or two, and it's like setting yourself before the game, if you like. So S is stopping, and it's just taking a minute to disconnect with whatever you're doing. And that can be very important if you're pretty scattered. And so this, for me, the S is it's like a move into myself. It's like I'm going to shift my energy from out there to in here. That's why S is for me pretty critical. So S is to stop. T is taking a couple of conscious breaths. So just taking two or three conscious breaths. And noticing the sensations of the in-breath, the out-breath, and not trying to control the breathing in any way, but just noticing the breathing. When we're under a lot of pressure, the breathing can become very shallow. And there's a lot of evidence that connecting with the breathing in that kind of intentional way is very effective in calming down the nervous system or that fight response. So that's T. O is observing. So just having a sense of observation of the environment that I'm in, the place that I'm in. You might feel the feet on the floor, grounding yourself. So bringing your attention to where you are, not all the million things that you're thinking about. And also observing your emotions, the emotional ground that you're kind of resting on right now. And that's that attitudinal piece that I talked about before. And then also observing what's going on in the mind. What am I thinking? What am I holding on to here? What am I holding on to that I can actually let go of for this next moment that I'm about to go into? And then lastly is P, which is proceeding with intention. And that's that fourth core habit that I mentioned, the intent. And that's everything, because that is like, what am I wanting to be in service of in this moment? And if you're about to go into a big conversation, a challenging interpersonal moment, that can be very, very powerful. So that's the stop, Lisa. And yeah, I find it really useful.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much, James.
Fantastic, Lisa. Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. James Donald is a senior lecturer in work and organisational studies at Sydney University. Thanks for listening to This Working Life. It was produced by Rob Kelly and engineered by Tim James on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Melbourne. Today's This Working Life radio drama was brought to you by our hardworking actors, me and producer Rob. We did miss out on the Logies, but we look forward to the Oscars. If you'd like to hear more from us, you can like or subscribe to our show on ABC Listen or anywhere you get your podcasts. And please do rate and review us while you're there. I'm Lisa Leong. Until next time, stop and love your work.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.